Howdy, everybody. This is this is your friend here in Little Saigon, Seattle, and I am talking to my friend AJ in Florida today. It is, just to let you know, it is November the 13th, 2019, and it is Wednesday. How's it going, AJ?
It's going very well, Dan. How are you doing?
I'm doing okay. This is going to be the first time I use Skype for these types of podcasts, so I'm hopeful in the way that, you know, one can be hopeful that the crocodile doesn't take a shit on you.
They have to give us a few good things now and then to let us work with. It can't be all garbage. So you're coming in clear, so hopefully it catches together on the when it ties back in.
But well, you know. So the audience knows we did a couple test recordings. Skype on Linux, just FYI, if you run Linux, Skype on Linux has similar features to regular Skype. You can record a call now. These recordings, quote unquote, only stay available for 30 days, which is fine. I don't give a fuck. I truly don't know if there's a time limit on this, like if you have to pay a fee to record a call that lasts longer than 20 minutes or something. Guess what? We're going to find out this morning. But it seems to be coming through. I opened it up in Audacity. The audio quality wasn't perfect, but it was better than the phone call. So I think we start from there. And then another thing too, Audacity has a pretty good noise reduction filter. So even with little bits of noise, it's possible to remove that shit too. So I don't know why I'm going off on this tangent, but I'm happy if this works. If I can record calls like this, then I can start doing more interviews and not just bloviating.
Yeah, I would love to hear other interviews with your listeners, because I was meditating on this the other day. The types of people that are gave you a shot to listen to and then stuck with it is an interesting person, I think, because they of course have seen their paradigm is ready to be shifted and their eyes are open. But you have such a unique and I find very constructive outlook on things, even though it doesn't appear that way on the surface level. There's a lot of other things going on underneath it that you can take from your work that I enjoy personally. So to hear some of the stories and people out there, what they're up to and what they're doing. You mentioned on the second to last podcast, a couple of them work for the crocodile and how they're managing that. I can relate, being a teacher for 10 years. So, yeah, it'd be wonderful if this works.
Well, I'm excited. How is the weather in Florida this morning?
It's a little chilly. It's about 40 degrees, but no complaints. I'm from Chicago originally, so I really enjoyed this because we had a extremely hot summer, and the sun had this extra bite to it that I had not experienced having been down in Florida for 10 summers. It was very unusual and to be noted, but what are you going to do?
I don't know. I mean, I think about the weather, and part of me is like, why should I care? I can't do anything about it. In all reality, it doesn't really matter if it's all natural, all human, or somewhere in between. I don't know. I don't put it past. Here's where I start with what they will or won't do. I don't put it past them fucking with the weather, but I truly don't know. I don't know. The weather's been weird here too, AJ, but I don't know what's causing it. There's some people who think we're on the verge of a pole shift. Well, that sounds great. The problem is, though, is a lot of the fucking – and maybe we can talk about this for a second. There's a lot of fucking what I would call apocalypse switching that goes on in people's brains when they try to figure out a way for them to survive. Like, there's two ways you can survive. You can approach reality for what it is, which I kind of think makes the most sense. Or you can say, well, the apocalypse that might be coming is not one I'm even remotely capable of dealing with, so I'm going to glom on to another kind of apocalypse that I can totally deal with and totally prep for. I feel like there are a lot of people like that.
Yeah, and they're thinking in the other apocalypse. How can I think what would be a better version of that? Could you give me an example?
I give you an example?
Please.
There are a lot of people right now who believe we're on the verge of a grand solar minimum, and ergo, there's going to be a little ice age, and therefore, prepare for that. But the thing I wonder is it because you're certain this is going to happen, or because that scenario is something that you can feasibly prepare for?
Yeah, yeah. So, lesser of two evils and help you sleep at night.
The nightmare that's the least scary.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, I don't know what's going on. The weather, and that it is one thing that drives my need to be independent of the system, because there is something manipulation going on, because nature hates straight lines, Dan. So when I look up and see those stripe checkerboard cloud patterns, that's not normal. Why are they doing it? Are they doing it to protect us because the sun's getting too hot? I did notice on the couple of days they didn't chemtrail down Florida, it was much hotter. I would rather them not manipulate the weather, or at least be transparent, which they never will be. So there is something going on. We can all agree there. But what it is, who knows? So I think you just have to have your head on a swivel and be looking at your options. And for me, it's just food, water, shelter. I love when you say that. It could not be said enough, because we take those things for granted with the just-in-time production setup that we, and all the farming out globalization that's gone on, that to just in the back of your mind have a couple safety valves. And for me, I'm not a gun person. I don't own a gun. I don't have any plan to own a gun, because I have faith that I'll be directed to do what I need to do and move my family. For me, a good hiding spot. You know, it's hard to hit a moving target. I don't want to be around fighting for scraps with the zombies. I want to be on a boat down in South America. I don't say that in jest either. I do mean that. I would, if I saw that the tide's turning, I would get on a boat with my family and get out. It just would not be something. I don't want to stick around and have a shootout with the zombies.
I don't either. I mean, I was thinking about this yesterday. I've mentioned this before in previous podcasts. There are these different strategies that people think about, and there are strategies that are foisted on people, almost like propaganda. Do you remember that movie World War Z?
I didn't see it, but I know, with Brad Pitt. Yeah.
Oh yeah. Well, anyways, Brad Pitt is, and again, I never read the book, so I don't give a fuck if the book is like the movie. That's a whole nother topic. For all you guys out there, I read the book. I don't care. But in the movie, Brad Pitt is this super expert on failed states, and he's a UN technocrat, and he's a guy who knows how to go in and get shit done. And one of the things he tells these people that he ends up meeting along the way during the apocalypse is that the best thing you can do is keep moving. And I thought to myself, holy fuck, that is literally the stupidest fucking advice you can possibly give somebody in the middle of a chaos situation, especially at the beginning. Okay, the best advice I can give to anybody at the beginning of any major event: barricade your fucking door if you can, and stay put for a while. Probably for a few weeks, but at least for a fucking day or two. Don't go anywhere.
Yes, to see how things are playing out. It's crazy, because all the different scenarios I've run through in my mind. But if it were to be the point where all the power's cut, and of course, there's no groceries at the store, and the water lines are tapped out.
Let me correct myself. Okay. I'm not saying literally plant your feet and be unreasonable to move. It's more like, don't move until you have a fucking clue.
Oh, of course. Yeah, you want it. That's why I'm so attracted to the ocean, because it's vast and open. And I would love to hear any constructive criticism on that, because there's not much more of a plan than just the idea of having the freedom of a boat and being in all the room, and nobody else is planning for that. And I've got a stockade of solar panels ready to go that I could throw on there, little motors to run it. But it would be the idea that no one else is going to have access to fuel, so there's not going to be that many boats out there. The military, of course, would be. So that would be my biggest, I guess, adversary out there, but a small thing.
If I had the money, do you know what kind of an old ship I would find if I was going to do that, if I had the money?
What's that?
Okay, I don't even know if you can find these, but there are these old Coast Guard vessels, these really deep hull Coast Guard vessels that are designed for search and rescue. And they were built during World War II, because there were a lot of ships lost in the North Atlantic. Very deep hull, designed for very rough weather. I would try to find one of those, or potentially, you know, those emergency escape boats that are on those oil platforms?
Yeah, the rib things?
Yeah,
inflatables?
They're not inflatables. Oh. They're they're hard. They're, you should, I'll try to send you a link. These are physically boats, okay? And you strap into them, and they have like fucking safety seats and seat belts because they shoot off the platform. Like they get pushed off at relatively high speed. The point is they're built to like basically almost be submerged because that's how fast they go off the platform. But they're basically fully functional boats. They got an engine, everything else. If I could find one of those and just sort of, you know, improve it for a situation, like tear out all the seats. Because to me, having a boat makes sense, but I'd want something really durable.
Yes, and I would love if you'd send that to me because I haven't seen that version of it. I've seen the V-Haul from World War II's, but not the rip-out ones from the oil tankers. And also a good solution would be your dirigible. Now, that'd be too complicated for me to get up in the air, but get up there and cruise around, go where you want, that you on your bucket list or your fuck it list that you put out the other day. I'd like.
Yeah, well, everyone should have a fuck it list. And I don't know if these things have motors on them or not, but I'm going to send you a picture of one. They're fucking crazy. And if I could find one of these things, I think they potentially could be useful. And if they don't have a – in a way, if they don't have a motor on them, that's almost better because that gives you the option of mounting what you want to. For example, getting one of those fucking electric motors. You know those fucking and hold on a second. I think I can just send this to you. I should be able to just send it to you, right? Because this is Skype.
Yeah.
I'm should looking. Be able to just text it to you.
If you go.
Yeah, oh, I got it. I got it right here. Hold on a second. I don't know. Do you see that?
I've got the link. Yeah.
Yeah. So that's – and there's – I think there's different designs of these, but they're designed.
Holy cow. Look at that thing. It's that's exactly what I need. Oh my goodness.
That's what
I'm
saying.
Yeah, like a submarine. Like it's not literally a submarine, but yeah, you have all that and you don't have to worry about the weather. That thing is I've never seen that before. Oh, that's very cool.
With a little bit of work, you could mount an outboard electric on that thing. Maybe, you know, 10 horsepower. I'm just sort of guesstimating.
Wow.
You're not gonna go really fast. But with a little bit of work, you put a 10 or a 15 horsepower electric on it, put some batteries in it, and then put some solar panels on the outside and then have some extra ones inside. Another thing you can do with solar panels, you can put them on floats. So you could do something called a snake. As long as they're waterproof, you could have a dragon's tail of panels on a calm day, on a calm sunny day. You could, because people say, well, where are you going to put your panels at sea? Well, if you put them on floats, you can just lay them out behind you and then pull them back in.
And capture your charge. Using the anchor system.
And you can do that too. That's another way to do it. Yeah. I'm sorry. I interrupted you.
No. I love this boat. That's so cool. What do you think that's made out of? Is that iron?
I don't know. I mean, the thing is, if it was something – this is the thing. I've never even remotely ever tried to see if you could find one of these things like for sale. It would probably require a lot of research to find one that you could buy that wouldn't be grotesquely expensive. I wouldn't even know where to start, dude. But my guess is if a person did the research, they could probably find one of these old things. And a little bit of effort, it can become a way for a person to not just get out of town, but to survive some rough conditions. Because even under normal conditions, the oceans can be very treacherous.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Yeah. Especially if you're not seasoned like myself and don't have any experience, you don't want to get caught in a dinghy and eaten by the sharks. Let me ask you a question, Dan. I've got my HHO generator running really well right now. And just for the listeners, HHO, it's a hydrogen oxygen gas, but it's a highly combustible, high temperature burning fuel that you make from water. Anybody could do it. It's the simplest thing in the world, which is what I'm attracted to because simple is good, is if you could take a battery tonight and you could hook up two ends of wires, copper, whatever, one to the positive, one to the negative, put it in a little salt water. You could just take water and put some salt in it, table salt, mix it up, put them in there, connect to the positive and negative side. And you're going to see at the negative end twice as many bubbles. That's the hydrogen. And on the positive end, you're going to have the oxygen. So a little background. It's been around for a very long time, the concept, but it never has
seen... electrolysis.
It's electrolysis, exactly. It's electrolysis of water. But that when you combine the hydrogen oxygen in that ratio, you get this. It's the third hottest burning gas. And nobody that in the mainstream technology we see around us has put it to efficient use. So
the problem though, and I'm mm-hmm. I interrupted you. You keep going.
Keep going. Okay. Well, my question is, and this is the problem: how could we create some sort of not internal combustion engine, because for me that's too many moving parts, but some sort of like a rocket fuel, but not a rocket in the sense that you're going to have all that thrust at once and blow it out, but a somewhere in between that, but a combustion type engine to create that rotary motion or reciprocating in order to harness the explosiveness of this gas. Because it's, picture yourself out in the sea, and you've got all of the water, of course, and you could do the snake thing with the solar panels to split the water and capture it back on the boat and tanks. No problem there. But now that you have this gas, and you could picture propane gas, it's this stuff burns hotter, so it's more valuable. But how could you then turn that into some sort of movement to propel your boat?
Well, that's a good question. One of the problems – okay, so for our listeners, electrolysis has been a known thing for a long time, probably going back 100 years or more. But it's been a known thing. They've known that you can use electricity to not just, you know, split water, but you can split other molecules using electricity too. But water is interesting because, like you said, you get hydrogen and oxygen. And even though it's technically not the same stuff, that's essentially the stuff they use for a lot of liquid rocket fuel. So if the question is there a lot of energy in a hydrogen-oxygen reaction, there is. Now, in reality, and we just need to make this clear, I don't know of any over-unity method yet, and I'll explain over-unity in a second, but I don't know of any over-unity method yet that achieves electrolysis where you get more energy out than you put in. I just want to put that on the record. I don't know of any technique for doing that. So this is not free energy, okay? It typically takes more energy in to do the electrolysis than the energy you get out with the split hydrogen and oxygen. That's another thing we should mention before we continue. The other thing I'd mention is this. The big problem with working with gases isn't just deriving them, but it's compressing them. And compression is expensive. Like, let's say inside this boat you had a chamber where you're going to put the hydrogen and the oxygen. You're going to get to a pressure point with any really, you know, low energy system for essentially pushing around gases. You'll get to a point where you can't push any more in without a compressor. And once you have a compressor hooked up to your system, it's going to use more energy. Wouldn't you agree?
Yeah, I would agree. And right now I'm using one-way check valves, flashback arrestors, to get the pressure, but I'm only going up to 30 PSI, so I don't have
You can get a 30 PSI.
Yeah, easily. Probably, I think it's 60 without an actual compressor, third-party compressor helping the operation, using just one-way valves. Yeah.
Well, here's the thing I would say, and this is interesting, because this is where I'd let you chime in here, obviously, because I'd like to know your perspective on this. But I kind of felt like calling bullshit on the whole hydrogen fuel cell economy decades ago. Not because hydrogen is bullshit, it's not, but because using fuel cells to work with hydrogen is ridiculously fucking expensive. It requires a lot of high-tech materials, and frankly, I don't see the planet having the materials so that everybody can have a hydrogen fuel cell car. So I would not use a fuel cell to extract the energy. The only meaningful thing would be, as you're pointing to, as you alluded to, is combustion. So then the question is, how do you use the combustion? And one idea, it's very low tech. In fact, technically, it was the design of the first steam engine. And I think we talked about it in our first podcast, or we may have talked about it on the phone. But there was a philosopher slash scientist, either the first century AD or BC, by the name of Hero. And he had a little steam engine that was really just a jet system. The steam would run jets and cause it to spin around. So it was almost like, you know, if you can think of the inversion of a turbine, not mm-hmm. a turbine, but it was basically using jets to spin something. And then the spinning process would open and close doors. Mm-hmm. Now, this is not necessarily a great way to use steam power, but it could potentially be an interesting way to use the hydrogen and the oxygen. You could build potentially, and this is, I'm just spitballing, a kind of homemade flywheel slash dynamo system that was light enough that if you spun it up, that dynamo could be what's generating your electricity. And so, and when I say flywheel slash dynamo, you'd want to spin up the flywheel, and then the flywheel is what ends up generating your power. I don't know if that would be a good way to use it either. I'm trying to think of low-tech ways. Another way to do it would be to see if you can't, you know, like, for example, you know, in fact, I'm babbling, but this is what I'll leave you with. Here's a weird thought before you handle this one, because I've already said too much.
No,
you know that,
no,
you're not Briggs and Stratton, because when I took power mechanics, the focal point for like the first part of it was the Briggs and Stratton motor, that mm-hmm. basic sort of, you know, single cylinder kind of lawnmower type engine.
Yeah, that's, I thought of that. Yeah, just the old weed whacker.
What if you found an old, in fact, that's even better. What if you found an old weed whacker with a really lightweight combustion engine and potentially some very favorable stroke ratios and then just see if filling the chamber with hydrogen would allow you to trigger a cycle, and then going from there, like maybe what you do is you get the 30 PSI on your main storage chamber, and then you can potentially power a little motor. And then the question is for how long, because that's what you have to ask. How much storage space for how many PSI translates into how much work for how long? If you can figure that shit out, then potentially you've got your simple low-tech answer to how am I going to use this hydrogen?
Yes. I definitely want to try the two-stroke engine because I've been wrestling with this idea in my head, because it just seems so simple to have this beautiful fuel source that burns clean. I mean, it's just the water. And that's what the exhaust is. There's no other emissions. So it's wonderful. But anything like a car engine, people have done that online. It runs too hot. It burns things out. The two-stroke is a great idea, Dan, of an old weed whacker or something, because then
a two-stroke control weed whacker. I'm sorry. You're right. Go ahead.
No. That's all, because I just want to agree with you as well on the fuel cell. That is a nightmare. I've bought a couple of them. I've looked at them. You're right. They're incredibly sophisticated. They do work, but the ones I bought are very small and not worth the money, like you said. But also the parts that go into it were made in a lab somewhere that is impossible to reproduce for the average person. It uses pyolitic graphite or something like that. And if anyone's looked at them, it's very, very complicated. So the two-stroke engine isn't that complicated with the pistons and just one cylinder to start on. And of course, they're readily available. You could find a used weed whacker anywhere on Craigslist. So definitely something you could stock up on, and not that big either to take with you. And you could daisy chain them together with a couple different turbines or props or whatever to move your boat when you're out there.
That's one way, yeah. Or you could simply use it to be your means by which you recharge your batteries. I mean, this is the question. How do you get from hydrogen to some sort of power? You know, you're right. You could hook up a motor in order to go directly to power, to propulsion. You could also use the motor to power the alternator or generator to recharge your batteries. I honestly don't know, given all the factors, what would be most efficient.
Yeah, and the batteries, now we're back to that topic, which is we discussed previously.
It's a horrible topic. And I've gone back and forth on this, but it's a tough topic. I don't know what to think of the whole battery situation. On the one hand, I know that certain types of batteries are going to be less and less, quote unquote, readily available in that kind of world. Anything high tech.
Yeah, and that's where the abstract dam, you could use that with an anchor system. This was your idea. You shot me that email 2 weeks ago on boats that you could create an abstract dam, the gravity well, using different anchor sets chained to the bottom of your boat on reels, on winches. So that's there, definitely is a possibility that we'd have to do some more testing on. My plan doesn't include any sulfuric acid cell batteries or anything, because I don't trust it, and they all go bad after a while. I want something I can do, you know, on my own. But I'm sorry, please continue.
Well, no, but then to me it makes sense. Let's go back to electrolysis, because electrolysis, true or false, basic electrolysis is relatively simple as far as setting it up.
It's two wires and a power source.
Right. Now, with respect to the water, does the water have to be exceedingly pure, or can it be relatively dirty water?
You could use seawater, yeah. You wouldn't want to use anything too dirty, but there's a lot of there's certain things you can't use with different electrodes. The electrodes are what they call the wires. This, for the listeners, that they would hook the wires up to, they call those electrodes. Certain things will create like electroplating. So like if you put a copper and a zinc on there, that the copper might go to the zinc, depending on who the anode or cathode was. But it's pretty open and not that many restrictions.
So you've got your, for the moment, let's say you either are using solar to do the electrolysis, or let's say it's the abstract dam type scenario where you're basically going to charge yourself by letting your anchor go in deep water, and it mm-hmm. slowly pulls out and it slowly runs a gearing system that turns your generator. So let's just assume you have a way to generate your electricity to get your hydrogen and your oxygen. You would need chambers, obviously, to store it. And in fact, when I think about it, I don't know. I mean, even if I could build even if I could have a compressor, I don't know if I'd want a compressor, because once you get into compressed gases, things get really, really dangerous, don't you think?
Mm-hmm. Yes, extremely dangerous, especially with those gases, yeah.
Yeah, so if you can get the 30 PSI, the only question is, how much does that get you? Like literally, what does that get you? Okay, so you've got your chamber, and it's filled with hydrogen, and your chamber filled with oxygen, potentially. Although, really, you could just burn the hydrogen, and you could save the oxygen for something else, because there is oxygen in the atmosphere. So you could, in theory, just run off the hydrogen and the oxygen in the atmosphere, but whatever. I think probably what I would try to do is research what are the lightest weight, maybe I don't know if this is the right way to think about it in terms of compression, but what are the lightest weight, smallest form factor, readily available motors out there that are internal combustion? So like what you said, the two-stroke weed whacker engine, that might be a good place to start. And if that's not enough horsepower, maybe look at chainsaw engines too.
That gave me another idea about the looking at other engines, because they do have a home generator, 5,000 watts, that can be fed off propane. And what you just mentioned about running it off only hydrogen, if you just run it off of hydrogen, it doesn't burn as hot. So it will be much, much closer to the temperature of propane. So if they have these generators that run off gas propane, and then you just run it off hydrogen, picking up some of those and throwing them on your boat, that could be a lot more potential for horsepower versus the two-stroke, which I'm still going to look into. Those are just fun and easy to get into. But the home generator that people get for hurricanes and whatnot, they make them off of
that's propane. A good idea, dude, because that solves a lot of problems.
I think you just solved my problem. You gave me that idea. So thank you, Dan. I think that feels good, because you could pick those up. They're not that expensive and not that cumbersome to put on a boat.
And so let's follow this for a second. You've filled up your chamber. You have hydrogen. You have your electrical generator using the hydrogen, and it's got continuous power as long as the hydrogen's available. In that scenario, you don't really need a battery, because for all intents and purposes, the big old bag of hydrogen at 30 PSI – that's your battery.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And so as long as you've got continuous stable power, then in theory, you could even hook up an electric engine to that generator, and you could have it go directly. I mean, I don't know. That seems a lot less efficient. So let's talk about this. You can get your electricity from the generator. Let's talk about motive power again. What about turbines? Like, what about building a turbine to work with the hydrogen and potentially the oxygen? Because here's the thing. If you design the turbine correctly, you could actually submerge it. Like, you could put the turbine below the surface of the water. The water would act as a natural mechanism for cooling. So you could even burn a little hotter. So what about either a Stirling engine, like you know we talked about before, or a little turbine engine, so you can get direct motive power from the hydrogen.
I like that idea. To be honest with you, Dan, turbines are a blind spot for me as far as how they work. I've watched a lot of videos and looked at the pictures and seen that, but constructing it, it's got the vortex action, but...
Yeah, the problem is that you just pointed something out. This falls into the category of really, really difficult to fabricate.
That's why I've avoided it. Not that I don't respect it. They're awesome. I mean, looking at the jets that fly over your head, I drop my jaw every time I see it. But it's so hard to fabricate. But if you could pick some up, they're expensive. Yeah,
What about? I mean, I don't even know how big Stirling engines get, like how many horsepower. But what about researching Stirling engines and then just using the hydrogen to basically heat the Stirling engine?
Yeah, I like the Stirling engine. Definitely an untapped thing in the zeitgeist of society thinking about motors. It got lost along the way because they've come up with so many different adaptations to it that you can do a heat version of it, which there you go, you can just burn the gas, you don't have to have it just an open flame, will run the engine. So yeah, I like the Stirling engine a lot, Dan. And the other thing we keep forgetting that just hit me is wind. You can create these. I mentioned in the last podcast the Lilienpeller design, which is just taken from nature. It's a spiral shape like a vortex, and it acts a bit like a turbine, but it's incredibly simple. You just have a center pole, and then you have two leaves that wrap around in the same direction to catch the wind. And you could fabricate that out of aluminum flashing, very easily. And then you would hook that up to a ball bearing. The center part would be hooked up to a ball bearing, and then that would turn, and you would generate power via induction with the copper motor generator setup that you'd have underneath it. So I like to have an eclectic array of options in my mind when I play my fantasy Escape from Florida game of how I'm going to get out. But solar's in my back pocket, and something about wind and the hydrogen and then the abstract dam. I like that a lot as well, because that takes so little there's very little complications with that, and is very easy to fabricate.
It's a tough one, because I really don't know. So here's my, you want to know what my great prepping plan is?
You probably
already know. In fact, I probably already told you. I've told everybody when I bring it up. My great prepping plan currently is to do almost none, and to the extent that I can afford to, which again, you know, is a function of how much I'm willing to write computer programs at this point, I just want to enjoy the normality as long as it lasts. I'm kind of in that place. I'm not saying I like it. This is not me saying, oh, I love the current state of affairs. That's not it at all. It's more like there are things we take for granted today that are just not going to be available, like going to the grocery store and getting whatever food you want. Mm-hmm. I don't think that's going to be a thing in a year or two.
Yes, I try to appreciate that as well, because yeah, if you want to, I like hamburgers. So we have a Sonic's down here, whatever the local chain, best hamburger that you can get, fast food. I'll go there and I think, yeah, what happens 2 years from now? I'll look back and I know I'll be craving, if I'm eating sunflower seeds, I'll be craving a hamburger, and to just appreciate it, because like the Skype phone call, it's not all bad. The society we live in, there's a lot of good things. It could be much better if we didn't have the crocodile breathing down everyone's neck and acting like a mafia boss. But yes, I like your plan, Dan, because it's very appreciating living what you have, and also it's the serenity prayer, which I have to tell myself that if I can't do something about it, just let it go, take care of your family the best you can, and enjoy life, because that's, what else are you going to do? So many things can be out of your reach.
I wouldn't even claim that I have that serenity stuff figured out. I don't. It's more of just that basic kind of, And here, and I don't have a family either. So AJ, my concerns are not your concerns. They're not the same. I don't have kids. I don't have a wife. I don't have a girlfriend. I have no gypsy curses against me. So I'm kidding. But yeah, I don't have the same concerns. So for me, it's a question of what do I know about the future? And currently we're in the window of where we can just make wild ass guesses, in my opinion. Like every guess we make might happen, might not happen. We're in that window. Could be good, could be bad. I do think that there are more likely type events. And I suppose if a person were, well schooled in either old school catastrophe theory or what later got rebranded as chaos theory, you could identify the strange attractors and figure out where events are going. But all I know is that we are currently in that Markov space where tomorrow pretty much only depends upon today. And from day to day, I have no idea. What would I be preparing for? And maybe this is a good way. We've got about maybe 10, 20 minutes left before we close out the podcast. Maybe this is a good final conversation. Isn't a big part of this. And this is why by the way, before I open this up again, this other direction, it's a good reason to do the whole boat thing, actually. But, what do you do in a situation where you're truly unsure what the most likely event might be? And then added to that, I kind of think it could very well be a synthetic event. And when I say a synthetic event, I mean like 9/11, something completely constructed, created, designed. Nothing about it was real, in my opinion. Nothing was real. The whole thing was probably bullshit. I'm not saying people didn't die. That was probably the only thing about it that was real, was the deaths. But other than that, nothing. So I don't know if it's going to be a real event or a synthetic event. And if it's a synthetic event, in my view, it's a precursor to something like another major war. And if there's another major war, then our situation becomes hyperstatism. Basically where whatever bullshit we've dealt with since 9/11, that gets turned up 1,000,000,000%. But if it's a natural kind of event, then you're talking about scenarios where really the people in power are mostly planning on getting out of Dodge before the fucking natives get restless. This is the thing. You know what I'm saying, dude?
Yeah. Well, like, you brought up the censorship the other day. That was a great point about that. That's a sign of them losing control of the narrative, that the natives are getting restless. And yeah, who knows what will happen, but please continue with that.
Censorship, some people, and this is where you have to really meditate on this and think about it, but some people would think about the censorship as a kind of sign of power. But what if in reality it's really a sign of weakness?
It's absolutely a sign of weakness because they didn't have to do it before. And then all of a sudden people were digging into things like 9/11 or take your pick of the bullshit they've put down out there in the macro. And it's had to be, they shut it down. I remember 2017, later 2017, that it just, YouTube became worthless. I mean, everything just pulled up was a mainstream CBS, NBC news. And it is a sign of weakness in that. But then I think it worked. I think I don't want to say they're good, but they know what they're doing, because I don't feel as much momentum. One reason I really like listening to you is because I want to hear other people having similar insight and passions of the world around me, and not what they heard on Fox News or about the impeachment trial. I don't know where it goes from here, because we are in that great discontinuity. But Dan, could I ask you a question about the Markov chains? As far as if I understand it correctly, you're using the current day to make further predictions. But how do you make a prediction with only one day's worth of data, such a small sample set?
Well, okay, so a couple things. Don't focus on the duration so much. It's mostly about states and sequences. So let's say, for example, you took my checking account history and you ordered every fucking transaction in temporal order, okay, which means the first one first, the last one last, right? And then you categorize the transactions so that you group them. So instead of it saying, Dan had some food at restaurant X, Dan bought some wine at store Y, you simply group things into food, wine, basic high-level categories, okay?
Okay.
If you take those categories and the ordering, which is the date time of the event, you have a sequence. And that sequence is the basis of what's called, sometimes called, a hidden Markov model. And actually, this is an interesting conversation because this relates to the weather bullshit. So if you don't mind, I'm going to go off on a tangent for a second. Mm-hmm. A long time ago, about 10 years ago, I was working in a field called revenue cycle management. And this is basically that area of healthcare finance where essentially a bill, a medical bill, is either underpaid or it was overcharged. And depending upon if you're the payer or the provider, or, and for example, depending upon whether you're the hospital or the insurance company, the hospital being the provider, the insurance company being the payer, depending upon which one you are, you either think you're being overcharged or, you know, underpaid, right? Well, I don't want to go into specifics of that, but I had to do a lot of analysis, and we worked on a project for a company that did reinsurance, specifically reinsurance in the area of workers' comp. And so we looked at a lot of workers' comp cases. One kind of workers' comp case that's really interesting is back injury, because back injury can go a couple different directions. And again, this is very much a Markov problem. If you suffer severe back injury and you go down what's called the surgical route, and again, I don't know if it's still true today like it was 10 years ago, but the surgical route is basically where they fuse your back. You know, you go in, they basically fix your back by sticking a prosthetic into your spine, and now you're fine. The problem is that from a Markov perspective, that new state is technically a weaker state. Your back is technically weaker. Your back is actually less flexible because of it being fused. So the probability that you're going to injure your back again increases. That is the kind of Markov relationship where your likelihoods depend upon your current state. You made a decision to get the back injury surgery. Guess what? The next likely outcome is mainly dependent upon that event. Does that make sense so far?
That really, the back thing really clicked for me. Yes, thank you.
So imagine if 70 years ago, we're going to kind of change our perspective here. Imagine if 70 fucking or 80 fucking years ago, the powers that be figured they might fuck up the Earth's climate. And then some jackass comes along and says, listen, dudes, yeah, you're probably cooking the fucking polar ice caps. Yeah, that stupid Admiral Byrd book is going to show grid lines in the sky, but let's go ahead and start trying to freeze the caps. We can do that, you know, other than Admiral Byrd's weird pictures. And guess what? Those weird pictures will convince people that contrails have been around forever. So let's go ahead and do it. That's how that fucking stupid conversation could have started, AJ. And here's the thing. Just like fusing the back, every time we did that shit, we didn't make the Earth's climate stronger, more stable, more reliable. We made it weaker, more unreliable, less capable.
Hidden Markov.
Yeah, that's also a Markov process. And the thing is, the Markov model comes from something called the drunken walk. Like, the simplest Markov model is the walk of a drunken person. Are they going to go home or are they going to go back to the bar? And again, for Markov, who did this analysis, it really is a question of the current state. So the bottom line is this. When you're dealing with Markov-type scenarios, the product rule, which is the rule that says multiply A, B, and C, is the only rule that applies. So if A has an option called B, and getting to B has a probability of 25%, and if B has another event ahead of it called C, and C has a likelihood of 75%, you multiply the 25 times the 75. Does that make sense so far?
Yes.
And that gives you the probability of getting from A to C, okay? That's one of the cool things. And you can actually – another cool thing about Markov models is that they're very graphical. So you can actually sort of draw them out. You know, it's not just the math. You can think about it in terms of connectivity, because it's a topology. It's a graph. It's a network. It's a network of likelihoods that are directed, which means it's a directed graph, you know, graph with arrows. Anyways, I don't want to get too down in the details. But
No. That's why I asked.
A lot of things – in life are not necessarily as complicated as the Bayes theorem. The Bayes theorem is a very different type of probability analysis, and it's way more involved, and there are some who would contend that in general when it comes to non-trivial sets of relationships, there are no good unique solutions for most Bayes' theorem problems. I don't want to go into that right now. But for Markov problems, because it's all product rule, the solutions are straightforward, the math is very straightforward, and it does have the added benefit of sort of functioning in the context of how, frankly, a lot of people make decisions. A lot of people make decisions based on today, you know, in the current moment, what they know today. Maybe everybody does, but most people I know kind of make those "what do I know today" type decisions. Well, that's kind of a Markov thing too.
Yeah, your current state, because the Bayesian would say, "What's your current condition?" I'm thinking about the difference between the two, because then they back that out. That you've entered that subgroup.
Yeah. Well, like the thing with Bayes implies the possibility, and I'm sorry for interrupting you.
No.
Another feature of Markov analysis is that events must be mutually exclusive, or states must be mutually exclusive, which means that if I'm on Friday, I can't be on Friday and Monday at the same time. That also has to be true of the Markov model. With a Bayes model, you have potentially many states that can be true at the same time.
Okay. All right. So
that's
I'm processing this. Yeah. No, I mean? It does. But I hated probability. But this Markov, I don't remember that at all. That's I was one reason I was asking. But also, your current state definitely affects where your decision-making process. And that back analogy was really good. Thank you, Dan.
Well, yeah, and I actually think it could apply to the Earth's environment if the governments of the world are doing what Dane Wigington thinks they're doing, and that is using geoengineering. Then they are, for all intents and purposes, on a continuous basis, fusing, quote-unquote, the Earth's back. That's not good.
No, that's not good at all. But, they're doing something. That's a very frustrating topic for me.
But what I would say that topic is really frustrating. To get it right back to what we were going at, if your question is, you know, how would I make a prediction about the future given that we're kind of in the cusp of, you know, what you could call the great discontinuity, really it does become a problem of Markov analysis. I think you can still use trends, but I think you have to do hybrid work. You have to ask yourself, what trend are you on today?
Mm-hmm.
Because we can skip around on trends too as things get crazier. I actually saw a chart on Zero Hedge a few days ago that was wonderful because it literally showed a perfect discontinuity. Two different functors within the same Cartesian plane, meaning two different things with nothing connecting them. And I thought to myself, that is closer to reality today than what most people even want to realize. Or you know what's another good example of this? You know how you can have a machine with gearing and every once in a while a gear loses a tooth?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, well, it can still kind of run. I mean, you can have things that lose a tooth or get a bent tooth, and the gearing can still kind of work. It works in a really janky way. You can listen and you can already hear that there's a problem, but it still kind of works. I think it's kind of like this. At first, you lose a tooth or two, and the gearing is resilient enough that losing one or two teeth doesn't cause the gearing to grind to a halt. But how many of these teeth can we lose?
Yeah, canary in the coal mine, like the Boeing situation with that's come back and bite them with all their diversity hires. And it's just an example of one of the gears in the 100,000 tooth machines chipping off. And at what point does it start to break the will of the other people that they're going to do something about it, and everything goes well? I don't know how everything goes, but
I don't know either.
Be the great discontinuity. Yeah. That's what'll happen, and it'll be fascinating to see.
But what I can say is that if you were going to plan for it, then probably being on a boat does make a lot of sense.
That's the conclusion I drew. I mean, at first it's, well, do I learn how to shoot guns and do all that? But the idea.
Can we talk about guns for a second?
Oh, I like guns.
You don't have to like guns, but I just want to talk about this for a second.
Yeah.
Have you ever gotten into, or are you familiar with archery?
Not only very basic level.
I'm actually, I'm thinking about doing a podcast about this. I know I mentioned to you, and this could be our next podcast, but I wanted to think about a sort of a rethinking of more classic weapons technologies in a modern context. Archery is sometimes poo-pooed because people are like, oh, archery, this is the 21st century, what the fuck? But actually, if I had a family, like if I had a family and my youngest were old enough that they could learn to use a bow and arrow, I think I would teach my family how to basically use compound bows. Because I got to say, two or three people knowing what they're doing with a modern bow can actually be quite dangerous on the defense.
Yeah. And because even if you were the super expert on guns and then ex-Navy SEAL, eventually you're going to run out of ammo and the shop's not going to be open. I myself have contemplated ways of using my air compressor and boring out my sandblaster with a gravity-fed ball bearings. I mean, that would be pretty effective, I think. But along the lines of your archery, I like the simple approach and would love to have that conversation with you.
Holy shit, dude. You know what you should do or conceive of doing if you don't break the law? Maybe do a prototype that is within the law. Though I don't. What is within the law? There is no law. I am the law, right?
That's right.
I'm Judge Dredd. what about, before we end this conversation with the hopes of our next podcast maybe being about weird approaches to weapon systems.
Yeah, definitely.
What about building a little hydrogen-powered cannon?
Oh, yeah. That's something I stumbled upon in looking for ways to drive a motor was, propulsing object. Definitely, yeah.
I mean,
great idea.
Actually, if you could build a little hydrogen-powered, like even a mortar-style cannon, you could potentially hurl things at ships coming at you. I mean, you'd have to have an explosive probably. But anyways, it's just something I was thinking about. Or even potentially a flamethrower, although hydrogen wouldn't necessarily give you the reach. I don't know.
Okay, on the cannon, real quick, because I know we're wrapping up, but say take your most basic cannon, and I understand you have your fuel, whatever you want to use, black powder, hydrogen, and you have your load that you're going to shoot out. What's the medium inside there that controls, that forces it to go?
That makes it work?
That makes it work.
Not, if you take any internal combustion engine can be thought of as a reciprocating cannon or series of cannons. It really is the same thing. It's the gas expansion. So the gas expands, creates pressure that forces the projectile down the tube. And again, it's all pressure. Oh. That's pretty much it. An explosion creates pressure. Massive transition. Explosions are massive transitions from one state to another. In fact, an explosion, as you well know, is just a chemical reaction with a very rapid transition.
Oh, so the hydrogen that you could just feed the gas in behind the projectile and
You said you can get a 30 psi, right?
Oh yeah, easily.
Well, my question here's an interesting question. Again, you want to do this someplace safe, but could you fill the chamber of a basic kind of like potato gun type cannon to 30 psi, put a potato in it, and see how far you can launch a potato?
Oh yeah, I get some piping from the hardware store and test this out. I feel stupid because I thought there was something else going on, but if that's it just
no,
the linear
don't,
path
don't, yeah. Don't feel stupid. It is pretty much everything about working with chemicals in the context of power generation, in my humble opinion, is either about a slow motion or a very rapid explosion. Gasoline is a controlled explosion. You put a little into the fucking cylinder, you get a little bit of air, it mixes, you get the spark, you get the explosion, the cylinder goes up, it forces the fucking whatchamacallit.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, piston.
The camshaft through a cycle, and then that cycle drives the main gear, and the main gear drives the vehicle. That's an oversimplification, but that's
good.
You know what I mean? Yeah. Well, if you were literally just to have a cylinder in the piston and not connected to anything, I mean a piston in the cylinder, not connected to anything, which means if you did that, I'm pretty certain, and in fact, I think some power mechanics guys joked about this, you could shoot the piston through the roof of your garage, or potentially you could.
Wow, yeah, yeah, yeah.
Without it having the other side, it's action and reaction, it's Newtonian mechanics. You know, an object will stay in motion until it's acted upon with an equal and opposite force, right?
Yes.
Well, if you don't have that piston, that piston driving anything, it will simply drive itself, which means it'll keep going. And yeah, so you can launch a piston out of an engine block. I know you can do that, you know.
Oh, yeah. We definitely, for the next podcast, should discuss this. Dan, that's why I love talking to you, because you get the wheels spinning in my mind, and you come with that knowledge base where it just really helps me process my thoughts. So I really enjoyed this conversation. Thank you, Dan.
Well, I think for this one and for now, as I stated, for everybody out there in the world, it is November the 13th, 2019. It is just after 9 a.m. here in Seattle, Washington. AJ, thanks a lot. Hopefully we'll be back on with you in a bit, maybe a week or two, and we can talk about weird approaches to self-defense. Oh, one other thing before you go, though. Is that okay?
Yeah, weapons.
I would, the next one. In my opinion, I would definitely learn how to use a firearm. But if you don't want to, like, buy one, I'll tell you why maybe you don't have to worry. Because I'm thinking, worst case scenario, after the first couple days, there'll be plenty on the ground.
Like,
I'm just being the Russians. I'm simply like being honest.
The Russians in World War II, was it? When they picked up?
Well, yeah, kind of. More like just think of all the nutty people who are going to just go crazy as fuck. That's why I say keep your heads down. Don't go into the streets with your shotgun. Don't pick a fight. Why would you? Let the nuts clear themselves out and then gather up the ammo. That is a good fucking strategy.
Yeah. They always say that when if two people are fighting, let them tie themselves out first and then perhaps help if you feel like it.
It'll be more than two. Yeah. It'll be lots of
them. Oh, yeah.
And the dudes that drop the ammo, other dudes will go get it and they'll get shot and they'll leave ammo.
No. I don't know. I'm laughing.
I'm being honest here. Okay? I think people have these notions that just by buying an AR-15, they instantly become Rambo.
I don't. That's why I haven't even bothered.
Why. If you want the strategy of I'm not going to buy a gun or ammo before day zero, I'm trying to tell you why that could be a wise decision. Because I'm kind of in the same boat. I don't really have any firearms to speak of. I mean, I have a shotgun. That's it. The reason why I'm not worried about having an AR or something is because I've come to realize those weapons will be readily available within about 72 hours. Within 72 hours, there will be people in the streets dead and dying. I'm just being honest, dude. And there will be ammo and guns to be collected. And you can either let the crazies collect them or you can go out and collect them. Me personally, when I find the window, I'm going to collect whatever I can and bring it back to my place. But the bottom line is this. I think there's going to be a lot of guns and ammo available within a few days after day zero.
Yeah, that would because you have the people going off right away and freaking out.
Oh, they're going to listen to what did Brad Pitt say in World War Z? Yeah. Smart people are out there running about being all crazy like. Listen, let them be all crazy like. Now, that being said, before I go, I am not suggesting that people wait and watch the tidal wave. I am not suggesting that people get irradiated by the plant that's about to go critical. My suggestion is wait and see what the fuck is going on before you make a decision. Is that fair, AJ?
Yeah. No, I agree. It was cool when you said that. The voice sort of crackled like a broadcasting transmission that they put on the emergency system. It was a weird little sync up that only happened once the entire show. And maybe the listeners will catch it. But yes, I agree. Yes.
Well, anyways, hey, thanks a lot, AJ, and I will talk to you soon.
Yes. Take care, Dan. Bye.
Okay, bye.